It's a pleasure to really get going on an intense process over the next few months of four conductors who are all applying for the job of music director of the Spokane Symphony Orchestra. And so the fifth one, we talked to Morihiko Nakahara last fall, but four in a row, and leading off the pack is James Lowe. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
And let's find out who you are and your involvement, your interest in this. I guess the brief biography, and we'll know from your voice soon enough. You came from Scotland?
Yeah, so I live in Scotland now. I've lived kind of all over the place.
Were you born there?
No, I come from England originally, okay. But they kind of let me live in Scotland.
Yeah, okay. And just a moment before we go any further, there's so much seemingly vital music in the British Isles, of certainly the amazing orchestras of London, and then in Scotland, and all those places. Talk for a moment about that musical civilization and culture that you grew up into.
Well, I mean, a lot of it comes from the English choral tradition, certainly where I come from. You know, the cathedral choirs have been singing, you know, pretty much unbroken evensong services for almost 1,000 years. It's astonishing, really. So that's a huge part of it. And then when you go into different places in the country, you get different things. If you go to Wales, you have these incredible male voice choirs. Mm. If you go to Scotland, the folk music there is absolutely astonishing, and it's so rich. And everywhere we've got these great orchestras, and I don't quite know. They kind of survive in spite of everything because the funding is dreadful, and we fall between the old European mm-hmm. model of state sponsorship and private sponsorship, and I don't know how they do it, but mm-hmm. they do, and everybody works very hard, but the standard is great. I'm very proud. You know, British musicians, everywhere I go in the world, pretty much there's always some Brit limey hanging around.
Sure. Well, number one, did you grow up as a choir boy?
I kind of started a bit late, so I was 11. Yeah. By the time mm-hmm. they figured out I could actually sing,
yeah.
I was a bit too old to join a choir, because normally yeah. with the cathedral choirs, you yeah. join at 5 or 6, you know, really
yeah.
young.
Yeah.
And so I was in local church choir. My village, you know, have a church that was, I think, started building in 1111, which is, you know, pretty early building. Yeah. And then, you know, so I sang there and then did bits and pieces and started as a player much later.
And as a player and with what instrument?
With viola.
Okay, good. And came in through the string section.
Yeah.
Into that. And so then when did conducting just seem like the thing you needed to do?
Well, so I started with the viola. I played in youth orchestras and loved it. And from the moment I first picked up the instrument, I realized this is what I want to spend my life doing. And so my plan had always been to become a viola player in an orchestra. So I went to study at university and I planned to do a postgrad and then, you know, hopefully join an orchestra. But I had a kind of gap year between school and university. And a friend of mine, who I hadn't seen for a long time, suddenly got in touch and said, hey, you know, I do this amateur orchestra and we need a viola player to kind of help out for a gig, and can you come and, you know, stiffen up the section for us a little bit? So I went and had a great time. And he said afterwards at the obligatory curry that, you know, we always, musicians in the UK, we always have to eat a curry after a gig. He said, you know, do you fancy conducting something in the next rehearsal? Because you're going to go and study music, so why don't you do something? So I said, sure, why not? So I prepared Tube at 5 for the next rehearsal. And then at the end of the rehearsal, he said, you know what? This is your orchestra for the next year.
Nice.
He just donated his mm-hmm. orchestra to me. And it was a wonderful amateur orchestra who were technically, let's say, not quite of the highest level, but they played with such joy. And I got this wonderful, happy environment in which to make a lot of early conductor mistakes. So when I went to Edinburgh University, I had that under my belt. And as conducting opportunities came up, I just stepped into them, and bit by bit, I got kind of dragged into the dark side.
Yeah, nice. Well, welcome to the world of conducting.
Yeah.
And then briefly, we don't have to be that brief. You've been a lot of places already. It's, you haven't just been here. So give us a geographical tour of your past.
Wow. Yeah. So moved from Nottingham to Scotland, studied there. Then I came across Ben Zander, the English conductor who lives in Boston, after I'd finished studying. and did a workshop with him, and then got a phone call a month later from him saying, what are you doing for the next year? And my reaction was, well, morning or afternoon. And he said, well, because, you know, we decided we're going to set up this fellowship. There was a previous conductor, James Gaffigan, had done it the year before, but he was a local boy. Mm. And he said, you know, we've raised some money and we're going to get you over and spend a year in Boston working as my assistant and assistant to his orchestra. So I lived in Boston for a year. Actually, I lived in Cambridge for a year, which is a distinction that's very important for Bostonians.
Yes.
And then back to the UK, south of England, back to Scotland. Ended up working all over the UK, was with the Scottish National Orchestra as their associate conductor for a long time. Then working in Finland, been working in Japan, and ended up living in Berlin for 5 years, and finally just moved back to Scotland after living in Germany.
Finland seems to be a lovely place musically. We have some great recordings and some interesting music making. Talk about Finland's music.
It's an astonishing place. So it's the size of California with the population of Scotland. So it's got about 5.5 million people living in this huge land. So it's mostly forest and bears and elk. And they decided, you know, they've only been independent for 101 years. And they decided that Sibelius was their great cultural icon. And when they wanted to differentiate themselves as they came out of kind of Russian and Swedish rule for all those years, they decided classical music was going to be their identifying thing. So they invested heavily in music programs and orchestras, and they built orchestras in every town. So you have these little towns in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the forest, up in the Arctic Circle, with a fantastic chamber orchestra. It's really astonishing. And so Finland hits well above its weight in terms of music education and you know, particularly conductors. There's a whole raft of Esa-Pekka Salonen, Saraste, Oromo, Osmo Vanskar in Minnesota, all Finns, all of the same generation. It's astonishing.
Yeah. And then your Japanese experience was what?
Well, that was, so I was in a competition there, I think 2003. Mm. Memory gets a bit hazy after a while, you know. And won a prize, which took me back, which was wonderful because one of my closest friends, who's another conductor, was in the same competition, also won a prize. And so the two of us did this wonderful kind of Japanese tour the following year. And it was a wonderful experience. So I've been twice there, and there's the aesthetic idea that, you know, everyday little things should be beautiful, not just art, but the way something is set out in a hotel, you know, the way, even like stationery, if you buy a pencil, the way it's packaged. And it's such a beautiful thing for me that I really enjoyed working there. And the way the musicians work, the way they play, is also influenced by this kind of idea of beauty. So it's a fascinating place to work.
I'm spending time with James Lowe, who is in town to conduct the Spokane Symphony this weekend. And so, having talked about geography, does geography matter? What is for you the idea of where you would want to be making music and in your life?
Well, I think, to be honest, it's more about, you know, what an orchestra's for and what can it do in its community. So I think it's less important to me necessarily where that is as to whether you can do interesting things and whether the orchestra is part of the community or whether it's just a kind of machine that generates concerts that people can go and watch if they want to.
And so that leads us into Spokane. What intrigued you about the thought of, you know, Spokane's a long ways from Scotland and long ways from all those other places. In several ways, what intrigues you about the possibility of being a music director in America?
Well, it's specifically Spokane, I have to say, that intrigues me. So when Eckhart announced he was leaving, a friend of mine tipped me the wink and said, you should probably check out this orchestra because I think what they're doing is something that you'd be interested in. Mm. And so I did my research, and my passion is that I think the way orchestras work, and the, you know, like I said, we're not a machine for generating concerts alone, and we should be doing an awful lot of work connecting with the community, education projects, all kinds of stuff. And when I looked at what the orchestra here was already doing, I thought, yeah, these people have the right idea. They think the same way as I think. So that was the initial thing, to think, well, you know, this is a place where, you know, we could actually do really good things together.
And so So that intrigued you to apply for it, and clearly you've done some research. You see what has been going on. What strikes you more specifically? I mean, yes, the orchestra does a lot of different things, but what are some of these strengths, and what are some things you would like to either keep doing or start?
Well, I mean, I think one of the huge strengths, of course, is the Fox Theatre. I mean, it's an astonishing place, you know, and I think any city in the world would be happy to have that theatre. You know, I have to say London even doesn't have anything like that. The concert halls in London are all pretty bad. So for me, I mean, that's a huge thing. And the fact that the orchestra rehearses and performs in the same hall is incredible. If you go to the Concertgebouw at Amsterdam, arguably one of the top orchestras in the world, their sound is so shaped by their hall. If you hear them outside the hall that they normally play in, they sound very different. And if you hear a different orchestra in that hall, it kind of doesn't work. So for the orchestra to have that, I mean, that's a huge strength. Also, I mean, the thing like Music Innovates is a wonderful program. I've been a bit involved with Sistema in Scotland, which is the first transplant out of Venezuela in the world that did that there. And so, yeah, I think it's this idea of using music as a kind of tool, not just using it as an entertainment, but that it can help people connect to each other and to their help people connect to themselves.
And of course, within there's ideas and there's implementing ideas. Let's ignore the implementing for a moment. And what would be some dreams or ideas or possibilities that you've encountered in your life that you might like to try here? We won't commit you to these.
No. But the thing is, you know, what I've realized here, you know, that ideas are not in shortage. Ideas are easy. The implementation is the hard part. But there are a couple of, I mean, I can give you a couple of examples of social projects that I've seen and somehow been involved with and loved. One was a workshop the Scottish Chamber Orchestra did where they took kids from kindergarten into a nursing home with elderly people suffering from dementia. And they went in with a string quartet, a writer and a composer. And over the period of a number of weeks, they wrote a piece of music together, which then they performed in a kind of civic, you know, in a little auditorium for friends and family. But it was a wonderful thing. And one of the old guys said to a friend of mine who was running the project, he said, you know, he couldn't remember anything past 20 minutes. And he said, I don't know who you are, but every time I see you, I feel happy. And I think, you know, that what a gift an orchestra can do to give that kind of thing to someone. Also, there's something in Finland I've been trying to do and yet have to manage, but I will. It's a hill I'm going to fight on, which is, you know, the Finnish government give away a free box. It's called a baby box. So anybody who has a child gets this free box. It's like, you know, slightly larger than a baby, and it's used as a crib for the first few months of the child's life, and it has blankets and books on care. And I would love to do a recording with my orchestra there of some nursery songs and some folk music and a bit of light classics and give it away to everybody on our state so that you can say, welcome to the world, here's a little free gift from our orchestra. You know, all of these things can have a kind of low-hanging fruit for an orchestra to do, but they can have a huge impact. And, you know, don't mistake me, the season concerts of an orchestra, of course they're the pinnacle of the work. That's the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
And that should be, of course, the massive and main thrust of what the musicians are doing. But I think as well, if that's all you're doing as an orchestra in the 21st century, you know, that would sustain the big beasts, Berlin, Vienna, New York. But I don't think it would sustain pretty much any other orchestra.
So it's the community involvement, community engagement all the way around. What about the care and feeding of musicians? That's kind of a tricky thing, and especially here where they have to scuffle a living with a whole bunch of different things. And what are the concerns there that you would see?
Yeah, I mean, having been on the other side of the fence, being a poacher turned gamekeeper, I can tell you, I know exactly what it's like, and it's a hard life. You know, people generally see the finished product. But the sausage factory, which puts it all together, you know, you don't see the years and years of practice on the instrument. You don't see the rehearsals that go in. And, you know, I do so, every time I guest conduct somewhere, I always ask the orchestra manager, okay, when did they last play? What did they last play? And so often someone will say, well, you know, that they did Mahler 6 last night, and it was an out-of-town gig, and they all got home at midnight, and which 10 o'clock the next morning. So that's going to change how I approach the rehearsal for what I'm doing, of course. It's a big topic. The economics are very, very hard for orchestras across the world, and not just here. It's every orchestra I work with. I've not worked with a single orchestra that's not in some way struggling and making and really, really fighting for their existence. It's a hard thing, but I think it comes down to respect a lot of the time. I think if musicians feel that they're being used as workers, you know, down a mine and just used and abused, then you're never going to get good music making from that, because people need to feel that they can really, that their contribution matters.
Yeah. And you've had, what, 2 rehearsals with the Spokane Symphony?
3 now, well, 2 and a half, because half of ours last night got cancelled because of the weather. So, we'll call it 3. We'll round it up.
Yeah, okay. Boy, that's a little tricky. But, okay, so then what happens when you walk into a new orchestra and you start in playing, and what do you encounter, and what did you encounter this time?
Well, it's interesting. Every time you stand in front of a new orchestra, I always think, you know, it's a little bit like 2 cats on a fence eyeing each other up and weighing each other up. And you have, I think, as a conductor, you get maybe 30 seconds, if they're generous, a minute before they've made up their mind. You know, they kind of like, oh, yeah, this guy's okay, or he gets in the way, or yeah, he talks too much. You know, you've got a very small window. And for years, I used to spend a lot of time worrying about, you know, what does this orchestra want from me in this moment? And how do they like to be rehearsed? And how do they like to be conducted? And I realized, after a lot of bitter experience, that the only thing you can do is just be yourself. Make music the way you make music. And if they like you and you like them, that's great. And if you don't, you know, that's fine. There's always next week. And in terms of my experience here, it was really interesting, because the first rehearsal, yeah, like I said, we're just weighing each other up, and I'm seeing, you know, what they like to do, and they're seeing what I like to do. And bit by bit, I felt, you know, I have to talk to the musicians, see what they felt, this kind of energy started to come. And they are actually very flexible to move. You know, there are some orchestras you conduct who are, it's like pushing molasses up a sandy hill, you know.
Yeah.
It's like kind of trying to steer an oil tanker. These guys, if I move, they come with me. So it's really nice. So that means that for me, it gives me a flexibility in music making, which I think is hugely important. I hate concerts that just run on rails.
So less stopping, less talking, less explaining, simply more time making music?
Every musician would say every conductor talks too much, and I'm sure they would probably say the same thing of me. There are some things you just have to kind of stop and work on.
Yeah.
But yeah, the balance is always very hard to find, and you will never get it right for everyone.
And James Lowe, who's going to conduct the Saturday night, 8 o'clock, Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock concert in the Fox. And let's start taking that concert apart, and in a little bit we'll bring in the pianist who's also here. But did I read that you had suggested adding in the Liszt Rhapsody to the program?
Yes, well, I was given a program, and it was a little short. So I said, you know, could we maybe add something? And I sent in a couple of suggestions. And they chose the list. It's the piece that I'm sure everybody knows. It's one of the most famous pieces of classical music there is. It's the piece that was played by Tom and Jerry. I think its finest performance was probably given by Tom and Jerry in the Cat Concerto. If you haven't seen it, you can watch it on YouTube. It's really fantastic. And I have to say, it's a kind of a silly piece of music. It's not particularly serious. It was written as a virtuoso piano piece originally, and has been orchestrated for full orchestra. There are various versions of it, and this we're doing one version of it. And it makes a kind of fun concert opener, I think. But the original piece was the virtuoso showpiece, kind of an encore piece, I think, was the idea. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And then just in the order of things, will you go to the new piece Rise right from there, and then go back to Liszt to conclude the first half with the piano concerto? So what about Zhaotian? Zhaotian's Rise? It's when I talked to you 5 months ago, you hadn't seen the score yet.
No, but I hadn't. Now I have.
we would hope so. So what did you see, and then now what are you hearing?
Well, it's a beautiful piece. It's a really beautiful piece. It's the idea. It was commissioned for the anniversary of the First World War last year. And the idea behind it was he had been reading letters of American soldiers in the First World War writing home. And he'd been very moved by some of the things they were talking about. And some of the kind of the kind of day-to-day intimacies as well. You know, these people very, very far from home, put in this intensely dangerous and pressurized situation, writing back to their loved ones. So what delighted and surprised me is it's a very heartfelt and beautiful piece of music. So I think if you're commemorating the First World War, you could write something that's very violent and bleak. This actually is not. This is a piece that has, it feels a lot more hopeful to me. And I think it's very, very beautiful. So it's really exciting for me to be able to give it the West Coast premiere.
And he'll be here?
He's coming today.
Where does he live?
I don't know.
Do you know where he lives? Well, anyway, he'll be here, so that's good.
New York,
on the
I
west,
could be wrong, yeah.
Or maybe on the could west coast. Okay, and then we'll skip. We'll get back to the piano concerto in a minute. What's been your life with Brahms Fourth so far?
Well, you know, I've been living with Brahms symphonies for over 20 years, and I mean, this is really not an exaggeration, but every time I open the score, I see something different. I see something new. It's music that was, you know, for me, Brahms is the composer who, more than anyone else, combines head and heart. It's music that is constructed on a technical level the most astonishing way. And like I say, you will just find connections and musical things and structural things that, as a nerd musician as I am, really excite me. But as a casual listener, you're probably unaware of any of these things. All you hear is that this music is richly, deeply expressive and emotional and has a kind of a logic to it that makes the expression all the more heartfelt. And I think for me, he's the composer that gets the sound of nostalgia and the sound of regret, but with beauty in it. You know, there's this quality in his music that I think no other composer really came close to matching. So for me, the piece is, you know, it's one of my desert island pieces.
Nice. Brahms Fourth Symphony, which is the second half of the concert.